Welcome to the Visual Storytelling Podcast. My name is Fred Ranger, and I'm so happy that you're joining us this week for another inspiring conversation. I have a very special guest with me. Today I have Lucas, and I won't actually pronounce your last name. I want to talk about it. I don't want to butcher it. So we'll call you Lucas for now. And Lucas is a multidisciplinary photographer from West Michigan. And he is, like me, Leica fan. We'll talk about that. And also a very, very talented photographer. First of all, Lucas, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Hey, thank you for having me today, Fred. Appreciate you reaching out.
Well, I think we have a lot to cover today. We were very excited pre-show talking about cameras and all this great stuff. But before we dive in into some of the questions I have for you, for people who don't know you, can you walk us through a bit of how you became a photographer and how you decided to invest time, effort, and now make it your full-time job?
Yeah, so I grew up in a really creative home. Both my parents have been artists, and my mom has been a painter and a writer my entire life, and my dad has been a commercial photographer for the past 50 years. So I kind of grew up going to my dad's studio, being on sets, and being like, this is kind of the dorkiest thing ever. Like, I do not want to, like, this is the thing my dad does, right? And got older, got into my teenage years, took a few, I always kind of had a camera, but never really did anything serious with it. And then I started working and I was like, you know what, maybe my dad's onto something. This would be way more fun to spend my time shooting and taking pictures for a living. And so I started working with him. Actually, I was in college at the time. I had dropped out, and my dad was like, you can come work in my studio. And I worked as an assistant for him, doing product and commercial work. And it was really good. I learned a lot about lighting, but he had been so in on how he runs things that there was not a lot of like creative flexibility. So that, like, it was tough. And then I ended up going out on my own and working in-house for a place and just basically learning and making mistakes and practicing and just shooting every single day. But
plus he's your dad, so he can tell you what to do, you know, double what to do.
Exactly. Exactly. It's like, there's not like the, there's always the like trope of like working with your dad and it's like, exactly. Hold the flashlight, right?
Oh man. But, so Lucas, so how do we pronounce your last name? I just want to get this out of the way.
Oh yeah. It's Vanderlande.
Okay.
So you keep the E in. It's not super, it's Dutch. Dutch. It means from the Lendi.
There
so
you go.
It's a river that's in the Netherlands, and my family lived by it.
Nice. Love it. Netherlands, and especially Amsterdam and Rotterdam actually are some of the most interesting cities, at least for me on the street photography front. I really enjoyed time there. So Lucas, talk to me a little bit more about becoming a photographer. So you did mention that you decided to basically not quit, but decided to invest, you know, time into becoming a pro photographer. Was it hard? Was it a process to get to a point where you can say, you know what, I can charge for the work I do. I have clients, and now I've the confidence, you know, to go get even more business. How was that part of the journey?
Yeah, it was. I think so. For me, I kept kind of finding myself in places that involved working as a photographer. So I mentioned my dad has been a commercial photographer, and so I did a lot of work with him, and he taught me a lot of the industry. And then my mom being an artist as well, I think one of the biggest things that helped me in learning that was obviously having my dad, but not being held back by my parents. Having my parents really say, this is a valid life decision to be an artist and to work in something that you're passionate about. And so whenever those moments came up, when I'm sending my first quote, when I'm making decks and pitching to clients, I never had anybody really saying, you can't do this. It was always, you can do it. You're worth the price. You know how to take pictures, you know? And so that was really, really beneficial to have. And so when I really first started finding my own style and learning photography, I mean, YouTube was a huge asset for me. And it, like, there's so much information. It's so open now.
Yeah.
It's about how much work you want to put in. And I mentioned earlier that, like, just shooting every day and taking pictures every single day. And there's something really valuable about doing that, putting in the work, understanding the exposure triangle and getting acquainted with your equipment. I've got a lot of young photographers that are interested in doing it. And they're just like, I don't know what to shoot. I'm like, the more boring, the better. If you can make something that's boring interesting, like, that's, for me, that's what we do. I love photographing everyday life and, just shooting constantly. The more boring, the better, in my opinion. You can make it interesting.
I agree with you. And I think you mentioned something very interesting regarding having a supportive family or a supportive, you know, ecosystem where you're surrounded by art and it's okay to be a photographer. A lot of people don't have that chance, and you took it and you decided to, you know, make something with it. So kudos to you and to your family to, you know, understanding what it is to be an artist. And yes, you can make a living being an artist. It's not easy. It won't always be easy. No. And it's not the easiest path, but it is possible. So that's a really nice message of hope. Look at us giving hope to the photography community in the age of AI and all that stuff, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, AI can't even spell North Face right.
Well, there you go. There you
have it. We've seen that photo, right?
Like, yeah. I saw that. And I think it was also sports photography does really bad right now. Like, it has some weird stuff going. Let's not talk about AI yet. Let's talk about the art of photography, because that's what we're passionate about. So for you, what was the moment where you found that you had a, I don't know if I want to call it a style, but a voice in the photography community, or a way to take photograph that actually represents you? And how did you actually found out that you were developing your own style?
Yeah, I think, we're always evolving as artists and humans. When I first really started taking photography seriously, my mom got me and enrolled me in a class without even asking me at Compass Arts in Grand Rapids on fine art photography, and I built a really good relationship with my teacher that was there, and it really helped me, like, shape the way that I look at photography instead of just like a really pretty picture. It's a story that you want to be telling. And I think I finally, like, realized that I had my own voice and my own style when I wasn't looking at it as just individual pretty images, but that I'm trying to tell a bigger story in things, right? And I just got back from Israel. Don't want to give too much stuff away here, but, like, one of my big takeaways there with that story has been just the juxtaposition of man, right? There's, like, you're going to all these holy spaces, and then you have to exit through gift shops and everything, and it's like there's a story to be told there, and absolutely, that it can be told visually. And it's just finding that. And there's obviously the technical aspects of things that differentiate artists, compositional aspects. I, for whatever reason it is, it just tickles my brain to do a balanced composition with the subject in the center. But I think that always makes me feel happy. But that works out.
But Lucas, you're so right. And I think this is something that I'm becoming more adamant and passionate about. You know, that whole Instagram thing, I'll call it a thing, has taught us that one image, you know, like, and blah blah blah. And I think a lot of photographers are starting to go back to, you know, considering their body of work and long term projects. Yep. I actually just released one, and I'm so happy about it. It makes me so happy, and I don't care if nobody looks at it or like it or whatever. Yeah. But for me, that's what drives me, telling a story. That's the whole point why I started this podcast. So I love it that you are mentioning it, because you are a young photographer. I think I can say that you're a young photographer. Yeah. You're not 75 years old, and so you're part of that new generation that was not necessarily born, but that had access to all this social media platform and has been, again, taught about consuming images like if it was, you know, Kleenex. So what's your view on it? Because I know you're on social media, you're making good use of it. You're even, you know, you join our great community of YouTubers. I saw the videos you made. Yeah. They're really great. We can talk about that later. But how do you balance both, you know, long-term body of work type of of work and being on those platforms doing your stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. It's a balance, right? Like, you can look at people's work, especially on social media, and a lot of it is incredible. I mean, honestly, like, there's so much incredible work out there.
Yeah.
Especially if you don't live in a very big area, it's easy to get discouraged and look at things and compare yourself to other people. But I think maybe that's one of the reasons I love, like, the daily life photography aspect of things, because it's not, I'm trying to tell a story in what I shoot. And I think there's two separate bins that things fit in. There's content creation, and which would be a lot of the social media stuff, and then there's your work and the stuff that your art that you're really, really passionate about. And I think that I grew up on social media. Remember MySpace and Tumblr and everything, and just enjoying those platforms. But the, like, not wanting to diminish what social media has done for the art community, but also recognizing what it is, because it's not like I don't know. I think it's done a lot of good things. It connects people. I mean, we connected through social media, and that's really, really special. But it also can be really difficult, because you compare yourself to other people. You're like, if I only lived in this bright spot, or if I shot with this different camera, then people would recognize me. And I think becoming okay with creating work for yourself that you're proud of. It doesn't matter if millions of people see it, just like what you said earlier, like, we are doing this because, not because you're going to get, like, accolades from people online, but because you're an artist and you have something to tell. And whether that's just for your community, or if it's for your family, or it passes down in generations, and that story that you're telling is the story of your life. One of the things that I've been working on slowly, living in West Michigan, is, like, a backyard series, because I feel like I've heard it said that on the street, like, the streets are where life happens, and I think that that's true if you live in a city, but in the Midwest specifically, backyards is where life happens. And and maybe that's just a series for me and my friends, and that we get together and we do pool parties and grill outs and everything, but really, really utilizing social media to make connections with people that you would never, like, be able to meet with, but also not letting it get in the way of creating the things that you want to create, because it doesn't necessarily fit with your grid.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
I the famous grid. I completely agree with you, and it is offering you know, a platform to connect with millions of people. And never in time was it possible for one to reach millions of people so easily. You had to go through regular channels, you know, be published or have a gallery, an exhibition, or so on and so forth. Right now, if you look at, and I'll take one guest that I had on the podcast that I'm sure you know, Phil Penman, who embraced social media but had a 25 years body of work available to him. He just decided to not play the algorithm, but be native to the platform. He created, the photos already exist, but he decided to create a story, to your point, and use the medium for what it was. And, well, we know he's having a tremendous success through the platform. Yeah. So I think it's, to your point, the balance between having, you know, investing time in your body of work and not necessarily looking at social as the validation tool. The validation tool as an artist is the art you create and the connections you make in real life. And with this whole, again, I don't want to go to AI, but with this whole AI, it becomes even more weird, you know, looking at an image online. So for me, printing work and seeing it in person, I think it becomes even more valuable in an ecosystem where you're not sure, you know, what you're looking at online. I don't know for you, but that's kind of how I see it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I started printing my work, and even just like on small little 4x5 cards, just to hold it, have it around, and not just have things rotting away on hard drives. You know, I feel like for me at least, I go through my work and I'll cull through it, and then whatever I picked on that initial cull, until I go back and look again, that's just like whatever I picked. So like my favorites album on my iPhone is whatever like the highlights are. And then sometimes I'll go back to those days, even just on my phone or on my hard drive, and find pictures that I'm like, whoa, those were, were a lot better with a different perspective than I expected them, than I initially thought. And so having them just like printed and stored and in a spot that I can just like kind of shuffle through sometimes, really nice.
Nice. That's something I should
start. And then it takes, well, I feel like we both love film, right? And I think that's a huge reason. You called me a young photographer. I appreciate that. And I think a lot of the younger generation of photographers gravitate so heavily towards film because of, one, the nostalgia, but also it really does take it off of an online thing. You're creating a physical negative or positive that that you now have to do something with. You have to store it, you have to put it somewhere, and you get to look at it, and it's tangible, and it's like it really is incredible. So I think a lot of photographers are moving towards that. Unfortunately, it's becoming really expensive to continue
Let's talk about it, Lucas. So this is a moment in time where company, and I understand companies need to make money if you're Kodak, if you're Ilford, and so on.
Yeah.
But holy crap. It like costs $25 a roll, and then you have to, if you don't develop it yourself or you know, scan it and so on, it can become so expensive. So what's your view on it? Are you still shooting it? Are you going to keep shooting it even though it keeps rising? Or are you, or actually, is that the reason why you have an M10? Maybe I'm linking two questions in one.
Yeah, it is kind of linking too. So that's a big question. One, I've got a refrigerator full of film right now that I picked up, that I just like bought through the years, that I'm going to keep working through and keep shooting. But I've a few years ago recognized, I'm like, okay, this is not going to be a sustainable hobby unless I develop and scan myself. So learned how to do that, and I'm happy with where that is getting me, the results I'm getting. But I ended up buying a X100V. We're going to get into gear. And shooting with that, because I was, my Leica M6 was my everyday carry camera. I had it on me everywhere I was going. I was blasting through like 7 rolls a week. And wow. I'm like, this is absolutely unsustainable. Fujifilm X100V looks great. I'll buy one of those. And then I got a bit unrealistic with my expectation for it. I'm like, okay, I'm never going to edit again. I'm just going to like do it, transfer it to my phone, and then
film simulation all set. Then there you go.
Film simulation. It's there. It's good. And then I'm just constantly tinkering. I'm like, oh, now I'm shooting in RAW and in JPEG, and I'm not even using the JPEGs. I'm editing the RAWs.
And then you're trying to get to Portra 400, but then it's not exactly like it. And
I'm just like, okay, this is not working. And so that's when I bought my M10. I'm like, I bought the X100V because I wanted to not use my M6 as much for cost reasons. And then I would still shoot on my M6. And I'm like, this isn't working. I love the range, the like true rangefinder experience. And so I bit the bullet, sold the X100V and my Hasselblad 500CM to fund a M10, and I've been loving that. But film, I've now kind of designated toward my street work and my more art work. So when I know I'm doing a project, I'm going to be shooting on film. My backyard series, all on film. In Israel, I was there for work and for I wanted to shoot a project while I was out there. So I had my M6 and then my SL2 around me the whole time, and was shooting film for that. And I've got a few other projects that I'm in the beginning stages of planning that will also be on film.
So let's talk about gear, because although this is not a gear show, people like to understand what artists, what tools artists are using to create. And you've, I guess, completed the trio of cameras with the big SL2S, I think you have, and then the M10 and
I've
the
got M6. Both of them.
You've got both. So are you using them professionally and personally, or do you still shoot other cameras when it comes to professional projects?
Yeah, so I shoot on my SL2S and my SL2 professionally when I have professional clients, or when I have clients. I also work for a church. I work in ministry, and I'm their content producer there. And I use Red Komodos to film content there. But yeah, pretty much when I do a lot of side client work, and that's all with SL2, SL2S. And then sometimes I'll throw in the M10 now, but not nice. As much.
Nice.
But the M10 and the M6 are like more personal cameras.
Totally. And I think I described the experience when I did my Leica video and why I shoot Leica, why I have an M6 and an M10. Is that it's literally seamless experience. I don't know for you, but if I take my M6, shoot, I can go to the M10 and it's 90% there, although it's digital, but the rest, you know, to your point, the rangefinder experience, I find the M10 is the closest thing to the M6 you can find on the market. And even I've tested the M11, and although great camera, great features, I still prefer the M10 when it comes to having the most seamless experience between the M6 and the M digital series. If you want to send me an M11 Leica, don't worry, I will use it day in and day out.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there's something unique about M6, M10, and I think it's the kind of the perfect balance between digital and film. Speaking of using Leica cameras, what made you decide to use Leica on a daily basis? Because there's two school of thoughts, right? So there's the trend, right, where a lot of photographers are switching. If you look at like Peter McKinnon and all these guys that were shooting Sony, Canon, but then there's people like you and I that are, you know, spending our hard money. And I'm not saying that Peter didn't bought his camera, but let's just see, he has a different type of different type of audience on his YouTube channel, like millions of people. So what made you actually decided to invest in the Leica ecosystem?
Well, I'd always wanted to shoot on Leica. My dad shot on Leicas through the 70s and 80s, and he actually fought to have my name be Leica, and I'm very glad he didn't do that because I probably
Oh
wouldn't be
my
shooting on the
God,
system.
that would have been
I
very interesting.
I'm like, I thank my mom for that every once in a while. Thank you for not naming me Leica. That would have been really uncomfortable.
Well,
But
you went with something close with Luca, you know, like Lucas, you
yeah,
know.
Lucas is close. It's close enough. But I started shooting on Leica when I bought my M6, and pretty much from there I was scheming on trying to figure out how to get on the system. I knew that I needed to have something that was a hybrid camera, and so the SL2 system seemed perfect for that. And one of the big reasons that I ended up pulling the trigger, I rented one, and it was just the simplicity of it. I have ADHD, and having those like Canon bodies, the Sony bodies that have like so many buttons on it, like I feel dumb when I talk about it on YouTube or anything, but like it's overwhelming, it's overstimulating to me. And I like it during my entire career, I've had to, when I shoot on those, mentally block out those buttons because it's just like did I set them up the most optimal way? And like, oh, it's just, it was, it became, it got in the way more than it actually helped me. And so with shooting with the SL2 system, with having eight buttons on it, only three of them are marked and they're all custom, really let me just work and make it like really for one of the first times an actual tool. Like I hear people talk about like Canons and Sonys as just being workhorse cameras, and it's true. I mean, their autofocus is incredible, but I always felt like it just got in the way for me. And so the SL2 system was really seamless. The rangefinder system just feels very intuitive to me. Even though I'm left eye dominant, it's still very, very intuitive. Zone focusing is not as scary as people think it is. But
I agree.
I just, yeah, it's the first system that I've been able to really get past the camera and just be in the moment with,
Well,
if that makes sense.
I absolutely, and I can confirm that you don't have to have ADHD to find Sony cameras very complicated. And I say that I've shot Sony cameras. I've,
Yeah.
had some for video, for photo, and although I thought they were the best cameras on the market
Yeah.
for all the reasons we just discussed, autofocus and speed and so on. I ended up not enjoying the experience, not using them. So I'm with you when I discovered, like, I'm like, that's it. That's it's no longer
Yeah.
a question of settings and buttons and so on. It's a question of seeing and capturing, and the
Yeah.
camera just becomes an extension of your eye. And I know it's all cliche, but it's cliche for a reason. It's because it's true.
Yeah.
And everybody
Absolutely.
who think we're Leica snobs, just rent. I like what you did, Lucas. You rented a camera before buying, a $5,000, $6,000 camera. And
Yeah.
then if you're not convinced, stay with your Canon. Nothing wrong with Canon,
Nope.
Nikon, Fuji, and so on. But again, if you know, like if you rent one and you feel good, then the camera
Yeah.
disappears. And when technology disappears, this is where the magic happens. This is where the creativity, can be maximized. Speaking of creativity, I'm looking at the images you're releasing, and there's something unique about the tones that you're using. And sometimes, you've got this great chaleur, like we say in French, like it's the great tones and the sun and the warmth to the photo, the depth to the photo. Did you always, were you always attracted to that palette of color, or is that something that you've worked on and now you've nailed in the in what you're posting?
Oh, thank you. I've always gravitated towards warmer tones, and I think for a long time I was really interested in minimalism, in photography. And so really clean whites, but I always, even like if you looked back at that work, the it's still very warm. Because I'm not like, I don't feel inspired by the like really cool tones, if that makes sense. I'm always like you look at Ozark and it's beautifully shot, the TV show, but it's like it, I could I my mind just doesn't work that way. I could not like get things to look like that and not make people feel like they look sick. And so I've always loved shooting
Like
warm tones,
bluish
and part of
and
it's
whitish. I understand what you're saying. Gray, blue.
It's just I like people to I like things to look like it did when I was there, but just like maybe a little bit better or a little bit more refined. And I'm not saying that my pictures look better than in real life, but just like a little bit more refined palette, if that makes sense.
And I see that there's consistency through your work. Even if I look at the architecture photos you're making, there's that signature. I don't know if it's a signature, but that consistency in the look and feel. So I want to commend you for that,
Thank
because
you.
that's something that a lot of photographers are trying hard to accomplish and to do. And I think you've got it down to at least representing what you're trying to convey. Speaking
Thank
of
you.
consistency, you started publishing videos on YouTube. You've entered the world of sharing your thoughts and ideas and talking about gear and so on. So how has it been so far? I mean, I've seen you pop up in my feed. I'm like, nice, another guy that I can chat with.
Hey, thank you so much. It's been weird. I got referred to as a YouTuber for the first time, like a month ago
Did you get a little
online.
plank? Like, yeah, I'm a YouTuber now, official. Or a t-shirt.
Yeah,
Maybe
I'm
a
like,
t-shirt.
I'm here. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I should. I mean, that's the next step, right? Merch.
It's the immediate next step, and then you get then the haters start to show up. I just want to warn you.
There we go. Oh no, I mean, I remember. So I put when I posted my first video, I had wanted to start my YouTube channel for a really long time, about a decade actually, and I probably should have started when I wanted to, but I didn't feel like I had anything to add to the space. And now, after I've been working professionally for about a decade, and then really switching to the Leica SL2 system and looking for information on it and not finding anything, I'm like, well, I just went through forums to try to figure this out. Somebody else needs to is going to be looking for stuff like this.
I mean, you do have
And
the guys at
so,
Red Dot Forum, but it's more recently, yeah.
yeah,
And it's
exactly.
so
The Red Dot
technical.
Forum's
Like they're
great too.
doing test charts and stuff like that. It's really, really technical what they're doing.
It is incredibly technical, and my reviews are definitely not anywhere near the technicality of that. But
That's why I like your
so
reviews.
I thank you. But I remember posting my first video, and I was saying to my brother-in-law, like, "Oh, got my first dislike on it. Things are like I'm reaching people. I'm actually reaching people because like
People are reacting, yes.
people are reacting to it." So. And it kind of helps that I it's a shooting on Leica is inherently a polarizing subject. I feel like
Fuji can be
people
too. I mean,
are
I started on with Fuji, and it can be very polarizing too, let me tell you that.
absolutely. I think anytime you break out of the Canon Sony world, people feel very opinionated. But I think starting YouTube has been challenging but very very good for me creatively. Especially when you work professionally, you're a lot of times you're bringing somebody else's vision to life, and being able to make something that's just purely you. And I think like we talked about it earlier in the form of your body of photographic work, creating things for yourself that you're passionate about keeps the keeps keeps you alive creatively, really. And so I've really been enjoying creating content for YouTube. Instagram has been just a dumpster fire recently, I feel like. And with TikTok and everything, it just, I really feel like YouTube is a sustainable platform for a long term.
Yeah. You know what? I mean, I don't know what to think about TikTok for photographers. I think it doesn't help the perception that, oh, it's easy. Just buy a Sony. And I'm sorry to Sony fans. I don't want get a low angle. And here's five tips to get the, like, seriously, like, this, is that what photography has become? And it's okay. I mean, this, those are the trends, and I and you, I guess, need to get with the program, understand it, and see how can we have a different, maybe a slight different angle, a slight different vision, maybe, you know, mid to long form content. And, we don't know. I mean, the rest will be history. We'll see how that goes. But I do believe, like you, that there is a place for YouTube, you know, a little bit longer format than what we're seeing on Reels and TikTok and so on. Again, nothing against them. I use them usually to promote my YouTube channel, but I do understand why they exist. YouTube, I mean, this is a great place where you can make connections also. And I think you've been investing time into helping people develop film at home with the lab and scanning and so on. How has that been? Because I see, well, more and more content about it, but still it's something so unique. And so I would say for me, for now, difficult to understand how to do it right, that I think it's missing a lot of content like you're producing on YouTube.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm working on a longer playlist of videos going in. I feel like I've watched a lot of YouTube videos on how to develop film, and a lot of them cover C41, or they just like go in just like the tip of the iceberg. And by no means am I creating like an all expansive playlist of things, but whenever I get a new chemical or mix new chemicals, my goal is to bring you from you just got chemicals in the mail to scanning and converting your negatives. Whereas a lot of the videos that I've seen focus on just the developing process, and there's so much more to that, like how to mix photo flow, how to utilize photo flow, how to choose and find the right black and white developer, how to navigate massive dev chart, all these things that can be really overwhelming. My goal is to create a space that's going to just teach you in short, quick, concise videos how to mix these things, how to mix it.
I thank you in advance, because I will need to watch those videos, because I'm fascinated by it. I did it back then at university. I used to do it in the dark room, but I've it's like bicycle, right? If you don't do it for so many years, you forget how to do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think Kyle McDougall is doing it right on YouTube, right? He goes through the process, and he's one guy that I really respect. And again, he's not going for the quick like on social. He's like sharing the long form process, and that's
absolutely
very appreciated. Speaking of other, go ahead.
I also love and really respect Kyle McDougall. I feel like he falls into a very unique set of YouTube creators that, it, like you mentioned, he's not there for a quick like. There's like a subculture of photography YouTubers that are there to share their work, and it you can feel the difference in that. I think Kyle's one of the more forefront guys that's doing things like that, which is really cool.
Yeah. And speaking of other photographers, so anyone that you look up to and that, you know, gets you inspired, doesn't have to be a recent photographer, but like, what are your inspirations or any books you're reading recently?
Well, I, at the risk of sounding basic, and I don't mean that in any spite against these artists, because I really, they're some of my biggest inspirations. But Joe Greer is just absolutely incredible.
Yeah, man.
He gets a lot of hate, but it's so undeserved.
I challenge anyone to take photos on an iPhone like Joe Greer does. It's not the camera,
dude,
man. It's the vision. It's the eye. It's the light. It's the moment. It's the passion. Yeah.
It is inspiring. His stuff in India, I was going through his stories and he's just like doing these videos on his phone of strangers on the streets. I'm like, how do you even set something up like that? And they look so natural and so comfortable.
I agree.
Like, that's incredible. So yeah, I'm really inspired by Joe Greer. He's a great photographer, and him and Willem Verbeek,
they
both have unlocked something in color film that we don't have access to. So I don't know what they're doing, but it's beautiful. Mentioned Kyle, I really like his work. And then Matt Day, I think
Black
I'm
and
really
white,
inspired
man.
By him.
Matt Day, Black and White, it's out there. Yeah.
It's really good. And it's just he being a Midwest boy, it's very good to see beautiful images of normal things.
Outside of New York or LA or, you know, the usual.
Yeah, especially outside of LA.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's like I mentioned before, it's easy to get discouraged and be like, man, if I don't live in LA, then I'm not going to be taken seriously as an artist. And well, I don't think, I think that's not true, but I think you stand out in your storytelling abilities, right?
That's so true. Yeah.
Everybody has a different story to tell. So, and just being interested in other things.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, stories are everywhere. So this is what people don't understand. To your point, they think they need to be in a bustling city to capture a story. But guess what? The person at the restaurant at the corner of the street, she has a story and she's connected to this other guy. And when you start to look at the world in mini stories, then it unlocks, to your point, something in your brain that is just, you know, allowing you to create anywhere in the world. And yes, it is refreshing to go somewhere new. I mean, you're just back from a wonderful trip, it seems. So it's very inspiring, very refreshing. But you have to use that to also create at home, because I mean, some of the best work of Joel Murowitz and has been outside of big cities. I mean, I've seen some beach photos that are incredible. Not super busy, but again, he's using his talent and his ability to capture a story wherever he is. So I think this is one of the attribute of a good creator, artist, photographer, even painter for that matter. You can create anywhere in the world, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think sometimes going on trips as a artist, you're like, it inspires you, but then you come home and it's easy to be like, oh man, it's so gray here. Especially you live in Canada
and
I'm
the cold and the
West
gray
Michigan.
And
it,
the rain.
It is cold, it's gray, it's rainy. And this time of year is definitely can become difficult for me, but that's when I really lean into my black and white work.
There you go. You got to make the most out of it. And was it Led Zeppelin who said, "Life give you what was the make?" I forgot whatever Led Zeppelin said to take what you have and make the most out of it.
Exactly.
Lucas, so what's next for you? So you've got your professional, you know, business going, and on the personal front, you did mention a couple things, YouTube and stuff, but on the photography front, what are you excited about? Is it about the trip you just made? You want to edit that and start sharing it? So what's the next personal project?
Yeah. So right now the thing that I'm really excited about is the stuff that I captured in Israel. And I think there's so much that has happened throughout history in Israel. And there's obviously photographers that have covered it, but I don't think that there's been a lot of people today that have really been down in Israel and covered it. And so my next thing with that is I kind of talked about it a little bit earlier, but my working name for it right now is Holy Moments. And it's it'll be a kind of a juxtaposition, but also my goal in it is to show the real duality of man in a sense, and showing these really beautiful holy moments next to not so holy moments, if money changing and all that stuff. And there's one photo, we were at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and which is one of the locations that it's believed that Jesus was crucified and buried and rose again. And there's this stone that people believe Jesus fell on, and people are just like falling at it, weeping at it. And there's just a guy sitting there scrolling on his phone. And it's just like, it's very, it's hard to describe without showing, but it's very interesting to me. So that's my big project that I'm working on right now. And then YouTube content, creating videos. And I feel like I'm, as somebody who started less than 6 months ago on YouTube, I feel like I'm carving out a little space for me on the platform, which feels good. And yeah,
that's
so great. My goal is to make my first book, my first like zine. And that would be the Holy Moments. So
that's great. And where can people actually follow the great work that you are going to release soon?
Yeah, you can follow me on Instagram, The Dumpster Fire, at Lucas Vanderlinde. and then also on YouTube, also at Lucas Vanderlinde, Lucas with a K. So I should probably figure out a way to make my name a little bit easier for people to find.
Well, I will definitely put the links down below. So there'll be that if people want to click directly to your platform. But but Lucas, I wanna thank you, because it's been a very, very interesting conversation. I was trying to look up the Led Zeppelin thing. It's about squeeze me, babe, till juice runs down my leg. So it has nothing to do with what we were discussing. I mixed up two songs, so I want to rectify that so I don't lose any listeners. And also, if you've been enjoying the conversation that we've been having, Lucas and I invite you to subscribe to this podcast and also give it a 5-star review. And if you want to learn more about Lucas, I'll put the links down below, like I said, Lucas work. And also, if you want to follow me on all the platforms, I'm at Fred Ranger. Don't hesitate to comment on our YouTube, you know, videos. We're there. We're gonna respond to you. We're not Peter McKinnon yet, so we have time to respond to you guys.
Absolutely.
And again, Lucas, I want to thank you so much, and we'll keep in touch. And as soon as you have new work out, let's chat, let's exchange, and let's keep creating together. And also, if I ever go to your neck of the wood, I'll let you know. And please, if you come to the Montreal area or the east side of Canada, let me know also.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Cheers.